From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's a new year, but unfortunately, we're in the same pandemic. And since the new year, the country has hit a grim milestone. 20 million confirmed cases, 350,000 deaths on account of COVID-19. But there is some reason for optimism with vaccines available and starting to be administered. Vaccinations, however, have fallen far short of initial targets. The U.S. had hoped to administer 20 million doses by the end of last year, but fewer than a quarter of those had actually gone into people's arms. Joining us now to discuss the latest on the state of COVID vaccines around Illinois and other COVID-related news stories are Pascal Sabino, a reporter for Block Club Chicago. Hello, Pascal. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
And Mary Hansen. She's a reporter for NPR Illinois. Hello, Mary. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, as always, we want to invite you to join our conversation. If you have any COVID news-related questions for our guests, our phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. I want to begin by talking about the status of vaccinations around Illinois. Mary, we've heard the numbers. The U.S. is falling far short of its vaccination targets. How is Illinois doing with its vaccine rollout?
It's doing okay. I mean, I think, as you mentioned, everywhere we're seeing challenges. If you look at the New York Times tracker that's looking at the number of vaccines that were distributed versus those that have been actually given to people, Illinois is at around 41%. So I think at one point in the first week of the distribution, Illinois was sort of leading the pack, but we're kind of falling a little bit behind now. So I think we're seeing some of the same challenges that other states are in distribution.
You've reported, Mary, about how Illinois hospitals are focusing on vaccine education, but not necessarily a vaccine mandate for their workers. Has it? And there has also been reporting about I saw on Capital Facts, the political newsletter within the last few days, that noting that there has not been significant take up of vaccinations at the Illinois veterans homes among the staff. One home had fewer than a quarter of the staffers opted to take the vaccine. Can you talk about, has it been a challenge for getting essential workers to want to get vaccinated in parts of central Illinois?
So what I've heard from some of the central Illinois hospitals is that at first, no. I mean, I think we're still sort of in this first wave of distribution and, limited supply. And so there's still sort of like this initial excitement, and it's, the people who are sort of jumping to the front of the line saying, I definitely want to get a vaccine, and we're seeing a lot of folks who are working on the COVID units, really being potentially exposed day after day after day. So it seems like this first wave people are signing up, and healthcare workers are getting excited about getting the vaccine. And I think it's more looking, down the road as we get more vials of the vaccine coming in, where there might be, a little bit more hesitation to get the vaccine.
And Mary, what can you tell us about where Illinois is in working through the line of who gets vaccinated when? I mean, are we still in the phase where it's just healthcare workers? Is there any sense of when the next group's on the list? And ultimately, I guess the question is, the rest of us will be able to get that shot in the arm?
Yeah. So what I've heard from hospitals and public health officials that we're still, a couple months away from folks getting, sort of the general public moving down in the list of priorities. We're still at healthcare workers in nursing homes. Last week, I think CVS and Walgreens started distributing their vaccines to nursing homes in Illinois. So they're still in that first priority group, but starting to sort of move into other healthcare settings and long-term care facilities.
Okay, so that's about people who are healthcare workers, mostly people excited to get the vaccine. I want to bring Pascal Sabino into the conversation now. As I mentioned earlier, you're a reporter with Block Club Chicago, and you've reported on some vaccine skepticism, particularly in the Black and Latino communities on the west side of Chicago. What have you been hearing there?
Thank you. So my reporting, like you said, I focus on the west side, so very much mostly a Black community, and I'm hearing the same things over and over again. There's a lot of skepticism towards the vaccine, but also towards public health at large, towards the medical industry, and that comes from a deep and long history of abuse and neglect towards Black folks, and that's a history that that continues into today. You know, it's not just something that happened decades ago. It feels very present that the medical system was probably not designed with Black people in mind. The pain and suffering of Black people who are looking for care, trying to get help within the medical system. Repeatedly, people are saying, you know, we're not feeling listened to. Our concerns aren't taken seriously, and that's not just an emotional issue, right? There's tangible impacts that come from that, and the most troubling for me is that today, 2021, the Black maternal mortality rate, so the likelihood that a Black woman will die from pregnancy-related complications or die during childbirth, that's three times higher for Black women compared to white women. And that's just one manifestation of kind of this this history and the ways in which, you know, anti-Blackness or you know, the neglect of Black people feels very, very woven into the medical industry. And so people don't trust the vaccine. There's a lot of skepticism and there's a lot of hesitation. And it seems like there's a lot of work to be done on that front of making people comfortable and making people believe that, hey, this vaccine that got pushed through, fastest vaccine in history, to kind of come around. There's a lot of work that needs to be done to make people trust that.
What are you draw out in your reporting on this, some of the history, because you mentioned the here and now. Maternal mortality is certainly a big statistic. And we saw, even, I mean, it took a month or two into the pandemic before we started realizing, and I don't think this was a surprise to people who have long studied the healthcare system in America, but that the Black community in particular was disproportionately being affected by the virus, both in terms of infections and deaths in particular. But you also tie this to a legacy of medical studies like the Tuskegee experiment. Can you talk a little bit about that history?
Yes, of course. So the Tuskegee experiment was an experiment conducted starting in 1932. It wasn't supposed to go that long, but it actually went through 1972. It was conducted by the CDC and also the United States Public Health Service, where they were looking at the effects of untreated syphilis in hundreds of poor Black sharecroppers who already had the disease. And so these Black men were promised that, you know, you come do the study with us, we'll give you treatment, we'll give you free healthcare, but they never got access to the healthcare that they were promised. And, you know, syphilis is easily treatable. They knew at the time that that the disease could be easily treated, but the people in this study, hundreds of people, were never given the very easy treatment to cure this disease. And so as a result of that, many of the participants went blind. They lost mental capacity, deteriorated, and died. And a lot of those folks, they actually ended up infecting because they thought that they were being treated and they weren't. They ended up infecting their wives and children, who also contracted the disease, got sick, and many of them died as well. I appreciate that you kind of bring that up, because it's not just one isolated incident. There's also one thing that several folks brought up to me when I was doing some reporting on the vaccine was the legacy of Henrietta Lacks, who is a Black woman whose cancer cells, she had cancer, she was getting treated for it. Her cancer cells were harvested harvested and used with, her cells are continue to this day to be used in all kinds of medical, you know, medical treatments and things like that. Her family did not consent to it. They don't get any compensation or even recognition for the fact that this Black woman's, like, a piece of her body is being used all over in the medical industry, and there's just no recognition. So I think that that mistrust, it's seated in a lot of different places. And like you said, anybody who's familiar with the medical industry knows that like these inequities have always existed. Like there's absolutely a reason why coronavirus hurt some communities a lot more than it hurt other communities. And the pandemic really shined a light on some of those inequalities and kind of forced us to take a look at, you know, what are some of these root issues? How does our medical industry and access to medical care, access to the social conditions that allow people to live a healthy life, how are those things framed by, you know, the neighborhood where you live or what your race might be or how people interact with you as you're trying to get care. So I think a lot of these questions are kind of brought to the forefront, and it's really clear that, you know, we need some solutions that go beyond just clinical care.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about some of the COVID news around the state of Illinois. We're speaking with reporters Pascal Sabino, who's with Block Club Chicago, and Mary Hansen, a reporter with NPR Illinois, WUIS in Springfield. Mary, you've reported on efforts in Springfield to counter vaccine hesitancy in some Black communities. Can you talk about what efforts are being done there based on what we've just been speaking about and hearing from Pascal?
Sure. So I think, you know, attention is kind of, as we talked about, sort of just turning to the vaccine and wider distribution. I know in Springfield, SIU Medicine has been, you know, doing a lot of testing and things like that, trying to bring testing sites and things like that out into the community to sort of increase access for everybody. And they're talking about doing similar things for the vaccine. I think sort of in more general terms, I guess, to what Pascal was talking about. I talked with a researcher from Northwestern University Medical School who's done research on health communication and sort of developing messages around, encouraging people to adopt healthy practices like getting vaccines. And one thing that she talked about is there's, the attitudes that we're seeing, the hesitancy to get the coronavirus vaccine, the racial disparities there are similar to what they see in flu and pneumonia vaccines, encouraging those where, Black adults are less likely to get those vaccines than white or other adults. And so we're seeing sort of similar patterns. It's not a new phenomenon that's coming up, but something that we see in other areas of medicine as well.
Interesting. Pascal, we need to take a break in a few minutes here, but before we do, I want to ask, you've also recently reported on the coronavirus surge in Illinois prisons. And in your reporting, you write that 11,000 inmates and staff in Illinois prisons have contracted coronavirus disease. What's the situation there now?
Thank you. So we know that ever since the beginning of the pandemic, prisons and jails were early hotspots. So at one point, Cook County Jail was the single largest cluster of coronavirus cases nationwide. And then we look at Statesville Penitentiary, we know that was also one of the biggest hotspots for a while. And so early on in the pandemic, prisons and jails were very clearly places where, you know, they were just ripe for the spread of the disease because people have limited access to medical care. People have limited access to cleaning supplies, masks, things like that. And on top of that, they're in congregate living situations. So in a lot of these jails and prisons, people are sleeping in dormitory style beds, you know, many beds to a single room. Some of them are sleeping just a few feet away from somebody else. So there's not really the capacity to practice social distancing while you're incarcerated. And so it was, those were a really big area of concern early on in the pandemic. Come fall, we're seeing another surge that in some places is even bigger than the initial surge. And so in particular within the prison system, within the prison system, there are some prisons where we're just seeing a lot more cases than we did initially. I'm checking on the statistics right now. It looks like in Dixon Correctional Center, 543, 569 inmates are currently positive for coronavirus. At Lawrence Penitentiary, 879 people. Inmates alone are currently positive. So huge numbers of people. And then we look at the Cook County Jail. There's also a pretty significant spike within the jail system right now. It looks like 127 detainees who are currently in custody have tested positive for coronavirus. And that's on top of, over 1,000 people who within the jail who previously tested positive. And just for, for kind of gauging that, usually these days the jail has between 4,000 to 5,000 people in it, and there's a lot of people cycling through the jail. People don't stay in the jail for the duration of their sentence. They stay there until they're actually sentenced while they're awaiting trial. And so a lot of the people within the jail are presumed innocent. Lots of folks kind of cycle through. Going from the courts to the jails back into the community, and so it seems like a really big place of concern because mm-hmm. I've seen some studies that say that people going in and out of the jail are actually one of the main one of the big drivers of community spread as well. So definitely,
all right. Community spread is something I want to talk about. We need to take a quick break right now, but community spread is an important issue, and we knew as Pascal was saying, we know the jails can drive that, but also eating in restaurants can drive that, and that is something that one part of Central Illinois is planning to resume doing in defiance of state orders. We're going to talk about that and more when we continue this conversation after a short break on the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing our reporter roundtable on the latest with COVID in Illinois. We already spoke about vaccines, and before the break, we were talking about surges of coronavirus disease in Illinois prisons and jails across the state. I want to turn now. Oh, and I should mention my guests are Pascal Sabino, who's a reporter with Block Club Chicago, and Mary Hansen, a reporter for NPR Illinois, the Springfield Public Radio Station, WUIS. Mary, I want to ask, because you've been covering schools as well as restaurants and businesses in Springfield, just last night, the Springfield School Board approved a hybrid learning model for the coming weeks. What can you tell us about what is going to be happening with students in Springfield?
Yeah, so they have been all remote throughout the fall semester, and the school board has been sort of going back and forth discussing when and how to bring students back into the classroom, and voted last night to move into a hybrid model starting next Tuesday, where students whose families opt into the model would go to class in person 2 days a week and then learn remotely the other 3 days. That's the tactic a lot of schools have adopted to sort of reduce the number of kids in a classroom at a time. And they had, as I mentioned, sort of debated this back and forth over the fall, and they had adopted this list of metrics following some guidance, some recommendations from the Illinois Department of Public Health, looking at test positivity rate, the rate of new cases, of weekly new cases in the county, and the rate of or the increase or decrease of cases among young people. And so they had set these four metrics. And at this point, the county is not meeting all of them. I think at least two of them, they're not meeting. There's a little bit higher positivity rate than the metrics call for, and a higher rate of new cases, new weekly cases. But the board members who voted in favor said, there's a lot of kids who are really struggling with remote learning. The superintendent gave some statistics about the number of kids who are failing classes, which has increased over compared to numbers from last year. Parents called in during the meeting to talk about the emotional distress some of their kids are feeling from being online on Zoom all day. And they said our numbers are improving, and so we're gonna go forward with this.
Well, it, and we have seen evidence from other locations that schools can be reopened safely if you have the commitment to masks and distancing. But one thing I have not seen evidence for is that you can eat while wearing a mask inside a restaurant. And we have seen that restaurants are responsible for spread. We saw that Sangamon County last year, when the region was being moved into a more restrictive set of COVID regulations, the county decided to not follow the state rules and allow indoor dining to continue until cases really spiked into the hundreds, which was an unprecedented number for Sangamon County, which is where Springfield is located. And now, even though there are still scores of cases every day, the county is saying that it's going to allow indoor dining again. What is happening there?
Yeah, so similar to in the fall, they're saying we're looking at our own numbers, we're having, you know, local public health infectious disease experts look at the numbers, and we're going to sort of set our own rules for, you know, for when to open indoor dining. They pointed out that the positivity rate, test positivity rate, is much lower than it was in the fall with that spike and dropping now. And so they said we're gonna try it, and they are opened up restaurants and bars in Sangamon County, allowed them to open over the weekend. They do have some additional rules in place. For example, they're only allowed to have 25% capacity. They have to, people have to make a reservation or at least give their name and contact information for contact tracing efforts if somebody ends up, you know, testing positive. They're providing that information to the health department so they can do contact tracing. They also have to do things like if there's, an HVAC system or windows, they have to keep that running, keep those windows open to encourage ventilation. And they said, they do have some additional metrics in place to say if the positivity rate's above, I think, 8% for 7 days, if we start to see another spike like that, then they will close bars and restaurants again.
Wow. Well, I guess people can take that chance if they want to. It's not something I personally will be taking up. If I can editorialize for a moment, I don't see how you can be safely inside a room with other people who are not wearing masks, which is a necessary factor of eating. But we're going to have to leave this conversation there. I want to thank my guests have been Mary Hansen with NPR Illinois, WUIS in Springfield, as well as Pascal Sabino, who's a reporter for Block Club Chicago. Mary, Pascal, thanks for being with us and sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks.